Chapter 2. Abraham. Of the Oldest Servant. Abram may actually have resembled Eliezer, and again perhaps he may have looked quite different. He may have been lean, puny, twitching with restlessness, and bitten by the tooth of care. The assertion that Eliezer, Joseph's teacher, looked like the moon wanderer certainly had nothing to do with the person of the learned head servant as now manifest in the flesh. People spoke in the present, but they referred to the past, and transferred the one to the other. Eliezer, they said, resembled Abram in the face. The tradition might easily be justified in view of the one-time wooer's birth and origin, for presumably he was Abram's son. Indeed, some would have it that Eliezer was the servant whom Nimrod of Babel had given to Abram when he was obliged to let him go. But this was improbable to the point of impossibility, for Abraham never came into personal touch with the great power in whose reign his exodus from Shinar had taken place. The latter had never troubled his head about him. The conflict which had driven Jacob's spiritual forefather from the land had been a silent and internal one, and all the accounts of personal contact between him and the lawgiver, of his martyrdom, his languishing in prison, of a trial by fire in a lime kiln, all these tales, of which we can dwell only upon such as Eliezer told to Joseph, were either a random combination of legend, or were handed down from the most distant past and crystallized upon a past much nearer, that is to say, only 600 years old. Abram's king, who in his time restored the towers and made them taller, had not been called Nimrod, for that was only a regal and dynastic title, but Amraphel, or Hammurabi, and the real Nimrod had been the father of that Bel of Babel, of whom it was said that he had built tower and city, and who became a god-king after he had been a man-king, like the Egyptian Osiris. The figure of the original Nimrod thus belongs to times before Osiris, from which one can guess at the historical gap which divided him from Abram's Nimrod, or rather, one at least becomes aware of its immeasurable nature. As for the events supposed to have taken place during his reign, for instance, how the birth of a boy very dangerous to his power was foretold to him by his stargazers, whereat he had resolved upon a general slaughter of innocents, how a boy named Abram escaped from the massacre and was brought up in a cave by an angel who fed him on milk and honey from his fingertips, and so forth, all these, of course, have no discoverable historical foundation. In short, the figure of Nimrod the king is much like that of Edom the Red. It is a presentness through which shine ever older pasts, losing themselves in the divine, which in its turn issued out of the human in still profounder deeps of time. The day will come when we shall feel that the same was true of Abram. But for the moment, we shall do well to stick to Eliezer. Eliezer, then, was not given to Abram by Nimrod as a present. We must regard that as a fable. Rather, in all probability, he had been Abram's natural son, begot upon a slave woman, and born probably at Damascus during the stay of Abraham's people in that flourishing city. Abram had later given him his freedom, and his rank in the family was somewhat lower than that of Ishmael, son of Hagar. As for Eliezer's sons, Damasek and Elinos, the Chaldean had long regarded the former as his heir in default of legitimate ones, until first Ishmael and then Yitzhak, the true son, were born. But Eliezer retained his place and importance among the people of Abraham, and his had been the honor of going to Naharina to woo a bride for Isaac, the rescued sacrifice. Often, and with relish, as we know, he related to Joseph the tale of this journey. Yes, I am betrayed perhaps all too willingly into writing here simply the word he, although quite aware that according to our habits of thought, it was certainly not Abram's Eliezer who was speaking to Joseph. What leads me astray is the natural way in which he used the first person when he spoke of the bridal journey, and his pupil's silent acquiescence in this lunar syntax of his. Joseph smiled indeed, but he nodded as well. and whether the smile implied any criticism, the nod any suggestion of courteous forbearance, one cannot tell. Personally, I prefer to believe in his smile rather than in his nod. I incline to think that Joseph's attitude toward Eliezer's manner of speech was clearer-eyed than was that of Jacob's worthy half-brother. We are justified of reason for thus referring to Eliezer, for that was what he was. Isaac, the true son, before he became blind, had been a man of strong desires, who had by no means confined his attentions to Bethuel's daughter. The circumstance that she, like Sarah, remained long unfruitful must have determined him betimes to seek an heir elsewhere. For, years before Jacob and Esau were born, he had had a son from a beautiful slave, which son was named Eliezer, and had later received his freedom. It was, in fact, traditional that such a son should receive his freedom and should be called Eliezer. One might find Yitzhak's conduct the more excusable on the ground that there had to be an Eliezer. There always had been one in the courtyards of Abraham's spiritual family, where he played the role of house steward and head servant, and was, whenever possible, sent as a proxy wooer for the son of the true wife. Regularly also had the head of the family given him a wife, from whom he had two sons, namely Damasek and Elinos. In short, he was an institution, like Nimrod of Babel, and when he and young Joseph sat at the lesson hour in the leafy shade of the tree of wisdom beside the well, and the boy, his arms clasped round his knees, gazed into the face of the old teacher who looked like Abraham, and knew how to say, I, in so ample and majestic a way, strange thoughts and feelings must have floated through that young mind. His lovely and well-favored eyes were fixed on the figure of the narrator, but he looked through him into an endless perspective of Eliezer figures, who all said I through the mouth of the present manifestation. They sat in the twilight shades of the great tree, but behind Eliezer the sun-drenched air quivered in the heat, and a succession of identities lost itself not in darkness, but in light. The sphere rolls. Never can it be certainly known where a story has its original home, whether in heaven or on earth. The truth is best served by the statement that it takes place simultaneously and concordantly both here and there, and only to our eyes does it appear that it came down and went up again. The story comes down as a god becomes a man. It becomes earthly, becomes bourgeois, so to say. A good instance of what I mean is afforded by a favorite boast of Jacob's seed, the so-called Battle of the Kings, namely, how Abram defeated the army out of the east in order to set free his brother Lot. Later, learned editors and commentators state as their opinion that Abram followed the kings, defeated and drove them beyond Damascus, not with 318 men, as Joseph knew the tale, but quite alone, with his boy Eliezer. And the stars had fought for them, so that they conquered and routed the foe. It happened that Eliezer himself told Joseph the story in this form also. The lad was familiar with the variants. Everybody can see, however, that told like this, the story loses the earthly and therewith the heroic character given it in the saga, and assumes another instead. When one hears it, it is, Joseph too had this impression, as though two gods, master and servant, had fought and conquered superior numbers of giants or inferior Elohim. And this can only mean that the event is reconverted, in the interest of truth and justice, to its heavenly form, and re-established therein. But should we on this account deny its earthly one? On the contrary, we might even say that the truth and reality which clothed it in heaven go to prove the same qualities on earth. For what is above comes down, but what is beneath would not know how to happen, and could not, so to speak, occur on its own account, without its heavenly image and counterpart. In Abram became flesh that which had previously been celestial. He, based on the divine, he supported himself upon it when he victoriously scattered the robbers from beyond the Euphrates. Again, had not, for instance, the account of Eliezer's journey to woo Rebekah its own story, on which it was founded, and on which its hero and narrator might found himself as he lived and told the tale? This, too, the old man sometimes metamorphosed in a singular way, and in such a form has it been cherished and handed down to us. It is said, namely, that Eliezer, when Abram sent him wooing for Isaac to Mesopotamia, covered the journey from Beersheba to Haran, a journey which takes 20 days, or at the very least 17, in 3 days, and that the earth sprang to meet him. We can only understand this figuratively, since the earth never runs or springs toward anybody. Yet it seems to do so to him who moves across it with great ease and as though on winged feet. Moreover, the commentators pass over the fact that the journey was made as usual with caravan, with beast and pack. They do not speak of the 10 camels. Rather, the light which they cast upon the story tends to suggest that Abram's messenger and natural son covered the distance alone, and with wings to his feet, with such celerity, indeed, that winged feet would not be enough. He would need wings on his hat as well. To come to the point, we must conclude that the account of Eliezer's earthly and fleshly journey is an earthly tradition based upon a heavenly one. Thus it came that in telling the tale to Joseph, he confused not only the language, but also the matter of the story somewhat, and said the earth had sprung to meet him. Yes, when the young pupil's musing gaze rested upon the present fleshly Eliezer manifestation, the perspective of his personality lost itself not in darkness, but in light. And this was true not only of Eliezer's identity, but of other people's as well. It is easy to surmise whose. And here, as a sort of advanced light upon Joseph's history, let me say that those impressions were the most real and enduring which he got from his hours with old Eliezer. Children are not inattentive when their masters say they are. They are only attending to other, perhaps more important things than those which the severely practical master is commending to their attention. Joseph, however absent he might seem, was more observant than the most observant child. In fact, probably much more so than was good for him. How Abraham Found God. In the above, I have in some sense been putting Eliezer's master, Abraham, in the same category as the eldest servant. What did Eliezer know of Abraham? Much, and of various kinds. He spoke of him, as it were, with a double tongue, sometimes thus, and then again quite differently. At one time the Chaldean had been simply the man who had found God, whereat the latter had kissed his fingers in joy and cried, "Up to now, no man hath called me Lord and Highest. So, now, shall I be called." The discovery had cost much labor and even pain. Forefather had tortured himself no little, and indeed his pains and performances had been conditioned and compelled by a conception quite peculiar to him, the conception that it was highly important whom or what thing man should serve. That made an impression on Joseph. He grasped it at once, particularly the part about taking things seriously, for in order to give any sort of importance or significance to things, or any one thing, one had to, before God and man, take them seriously. Forefather had beyond a doubt taken seriously the question as to whom man should serve, and had given it a remarkable answer, to wit, one should serve the Highest alone. Remarkable indeed, for the answer revealed a self-assertiveness which might be called excessive and arrogant. The man might have said to himself, "What am I, and of what avail, or the human being in me? What mattereth it which little god or idol or minor deity I serve?" He would have had an easier time, but instead he said, "I, Abram, and humanity within me, must serve the Highest and naught else." And that was the beginning of it all, as it pleased Joseph to hear. It began with Abram thinking that to Mother Earth alone was due service and worship, for that she brought forth fruits and preserved life. But he observed that she needed rain from heaven. So he gazed up into the skies, saw the sun in all its glory, possessed with the powers of blessing and cursing, and was on the point of deciding for it. But then it set, and he was convinced that it could not be the highest. So he looked at the moon and the stars, at these with particular expectation and hope. It may have been the first cause of his vexation and his desire to wander that his love for the moon, the deity of Uru and Haran, had been offended by the exaggerated official honors paid to the sun principle, Shamash Bel-Marduk, by Nimrod of Babel, these being an offense to Sin, the shepherd of the stars. Perhaps it was duplicity on God's part, born of desire to glorify himself in Abiram, and through him to make his name great, that stirred up in the moon-wanderer, through his love of the moon, that first conflict and unrest, employed them to his own ends, and made them the secret spring of all Abram's later acts. For when the morning star rose, both shepherd and sheep disappeared. And Abram concluded, "No, neither are they gods worthy of me." His soul was greatly troubled, and he thought, "High as they are, had they not above themselves a guide and lord, how could the one set, the other rise? It would be unfitting for me, a man, to serve them, and not rather him who commands over them." And Abraham's thought lay so painfully close to the truth that it touched the Lord God to his innermost, and he said to himself, "I will anoint thee with the oil of gladness more than all thy fellows." Thus, out of impulse toward the highest, had Abraham discovered God, had, by teaching and by taking thought, shaped him further and bodied him forth, and therewith done a great good deed to all concerned, to God, to himself, and to those whose souls he won by his teaching. To God, in that he made ready the way of realization of him in the mind of man. To himself, and to the proselytes especially, in that he laid hold upon the manifold and the anguishingly uncertain, and converted it into the single, the definite, and the reassuring, of whom everything came, both good and evil, the sudden and frightful, as well as the blessed usual, and to whom, in any case, we had to cling. Abraham had gathered together the powers into one power, and call them the Lord, exclusively and once for all. It was not as for a feast day, when one sung praises and heaped all power and honor upon the head of one god, Marduk or Anu or Shamash, only to do the same to another god on the next day or in the next temple. Painstakingly they called upon each single god whose name they chanced to know, that the particular one who had sent the affliction, they could not tell which it was, might not be left out. But Abraham knew which it was, and taught his people. It was always and only he, the highest and uttermost, who alone could be the true God of mankind, who unfailingly answered man's cry for help and his song of praise. Joseph, young as he was, well understood the boldness and strength of mind which expressed themselves in first forefathers' thoughts of God, though many there had been to shrink back in horror from the teaching. Whether Abram had been tall and goodly to look on in his old age like Eliezer, or whether he had been little, lean, and bent of stature, at least he had had the courage, the consummate courage, which was needed to concentrate all the manifold properties of the divine, all blessing and all affliction, upon the one and only God, to take his stand there and to cling solely and undividedly to the Most High. Lot himself, white with fear, had said to Abraham, "But if thy God forsake thee, then art thou forsaken indeed." To which Abraham had answered, "It is true, thou sayest it, Then can there be no forsakenness in heaven or upon earth like to mine in extent. It is consummate. But bethink thee, that if I appease him and he is my shield, nothing can lack me, and I shall possess the gates of mine enemies. Whereupon Lot had strengthened himself and spoken, Then will I be thy brother.